Welcome to the Behavioral Health Business Perspectives Podcast. I'm Bob Holly with BHB, and I'll be your host for this episode, already our ninth overall. For this Perspectives conversation, I'm chatting with Sam Himmelstein, the co-founder and CEO of Family Spring out in California. Family Spring is a smaller behavioral health company that's seen some solid momentum over the past few months, and it definitely has big plans for the year ahead. I spoke with Sam about his past, why he decided to start a behavioral health company of his own, challenges growing the business, future plans, and much, much more. Before we dive into all that, a quick note from the BHB team. If you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or coming on to talk about what your organization is up to, reach out. You could reach out to me directly by emailing rholly@wtwhmedia.com. That's rholly@wtwhmedia.com. Or you could find any member of our editorial team by looking at the bottom of each story where our contact information lives. Let's get to it. All right. I am thrilled to welcome Sam Himmelstein to the podcast. Sam, so happy that you could join the BHB Perspectives podcast.
Absolutely. It's an honor. I look forward to it.
For those who haven't met Sam before, Sam is the co-founder and CEO of Family Spring, based in California, correct?
Yep, that's right.
All right. Well, you have a really interesting story. So first, I want to learn a little bit more about you, and then we're going to learn about the business that you're building.
Sure.
So tell our folks a little bit about yourself and your background.
Yeah, I'm by trade, I'm actually a clinical psychologist. So I went to graduate school, I got a PhD, and early on in my career, I really focused on working with young people, working with people impacted by trauma and substance use disorder and things like that. And I just knew there was a side of me that was always an entrepreneur. Like I wanted to do more than just sit in session with folks face to face, even though I still love doing that, even though I don't do it as much anymore. And I still have a great deal of respect for it. So I just knew that there was more to what I wanted to do and how I wanted to impact the world and the industry and the community than just doing direct face-to-face therapy, because I had all of these big ideas. I had all of these experiences working in nonprofit settings and in private settings and government settings and inpatient, outpatient, just kind of everything you can name. And so that's why I wanted to, you know, eventually start my own business and essentially run a clinic doing high quality clinical care, you know, mostly for people who wouldn't be able to afford it otherwise. So that's a big part of my story and why I'm here. And yeah, I'm happy to also share about my personal life or whatever you think your viewers would be interested in.
Yeah, I was going to say something that I'm learning as I get more involved in the behavioral health world is so many successful entrepreneurs in this industry, they're individuals who have faced a lot of the things that they provide care for themselves. And I was just reading the bio of you on the Family Spring website, and I think, you know, it mentions that you're somebody who has struggled with mental health, with substance use disorder in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as a young kid, I struggled a lot. I struggled with anger management, with other mental health challenges, with trauma, with substance use disorder. I was in and out of juvenile hall about 7 different times before the age of 14. So I was really, really going through it. And, you know, long story short, I was extremely lucky and privileged as well. My parents never gave up on me. I met a lot of people who their guardians or caregivers just weren't as present as mine. And that was such a big deal for me in my journey and turning it around. And I also met therapists, I met mentors, I met other kind of adults in my life who helped me turn it around. And with a lot of inner work, you know, a lot of meditation, a lot of therapy, a lot of personal growth, but then of course, those external supports as well, those people along the path of my journey, most importantly, my parents, but also those therapists and mentors, I was able to turn it around and go back to school. And I was very lucky because I, you know, most of my heyday of getting into trouble and being in trouble with the law and really being on a dark path, like, you know, I remember the judge at one point threatening me, letting him, basically saying in some words or other, you know, if you don't get it together, you're going to get locked up and we're going to throw away the key. And, you know, unfortunately, I grew up with some people that are in that circumstance right now. And so I was able to turn it around very young, you know, before I got to high school. And the last group home that I lived at, you know, in between all the juvenile hall stays, there was house arrest, there was obviously probation, there was group homes. The last group home I stayed at was my ninth grade year, and a relationship formed with a director who was former military. He was from East Los Angeles. He was a boxer. He was just a really multifaceted, dynamic person, and really just our connection grew, and it helped me look at different perspectives. He helped me look at my parents' perspective. And through that, I was able to turn it around, go back to high school, and really the rest is history. I went to college. I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to major in psychology. I wanted to help people in similar situations as myself. And because, in a sense, I grew up fast, you know, air quotes, after undergrad, I went straight into grad school to get my PhD. And I was just very laser focused on what I wanted to do. And like I said, I always knew I wanted to help people. I knew I wanted to be a clinician. What I didn't know about myself until, you know, maybe a few years after grad school was that at heart, I'm also an entrepreneur, and I wanted to do big things, and I wanted to build companies to have greater impact, even though I still have this very sweet spot for helping people directly one-on-one, you know, even though that's kind of few and far between in terms of what I do in the day-to-day now. But my journey and my personal experiences, and I'm not even going into every nook and cranny, you know, those are my personal experiences. I lost a sister to mental health challenges, to suicide. I've known many people who have just been through the ringer in terms of mental health and everything that goes along with it, in addiction and everything like that. All of that really just informed me and helped me position myself to one, help people as much as I possibly could from a place of compassion, and two, to see how mental health as an industry, you know, organizationally and systemically, how it can be helpful and how sometimes it cannot be helpful, and what those barriers are. So my kind of mantra to myself, with my co-founder, my business partner, we're always thinking to ourselves, like, what can we do to create something that is conducive to clinician self-care so that our patients can get served to the highest degree possible, so that we can prevent some of the things that, you know, happened to me when I was a kid growing up in my family, but also for the folks that are actually going through that. How can we intervene, you know, from an evidence-based perspective and really be there to support them and have them not, you know, lost in translation like a lot of people are in these major healthcare systems. So I'm very passionate about what I do.
So you always knew that you wanted to help people. Along the way, you learned that you wanted to be an entrepreneur as well. What year exactly did you launch Family Spring, and kind of how long was that idea kicking around in the back of your brain for?
Yeah, we technically founded Family Spring in 2019, although there were a bunch of twists and turns. The way it originally started was me and my co-founder, who I've known for about the last 15 years. We went to graduate school together. We just wanted to share office space at the beginning. That's really what it was. It was just cutting down expenses. Then when COVID broke, we were getting contacted left and right to do webinars, to do online things for parents, for employees, you know, because everybody was really stressed out. And so we thought, you know, he had the entrepreneurial bug like myself, obviously. And so we originally thought we were going to do something with mental health tech, just something very scalable, something kind of in the venture world. And we had a couple of ideas. Nothing stuck too much. You know, I went through talking to some different funders. But what we really refrained to, what we came back to is, hey, what we know best is building mental health clinics and doing quality therapy. And we knew that not because we had experience or in graduate school, they teach you anything about business, which they don't in psychology school, but just from our experiences and being in different nonprofits and different companies and in different clinics, essentially. So it wasn't until about the end of 2021, early 2022, that we started seeing a lot of growth. We hired a part-time clinician here, a part-time clinician there. Then we got our first big contracts, both with a government entity and a major health plan, the biggest health plan out here in Northern California, outside of Medicaid. and we were able to scale a little bit faster. And so since then, we've been recruiting clinicians and recruiting team members to help us with our mission, which is to essentially serve mild to moderate symptomology for people with people with insurance, with mental health challenges, anxiety, depression, substance use, trauma. And since then, since kind of early 2022, late 2021, we went from just having a small team to, you know, now we're going on clinician 2021 and 22 here in the next couple of weeks. And so we just, you know, we still feel very passionate about what we do. And we also love the creative process that comes along with building a business, even though, of course, as you know, and as your viewers probably know too, or your subscribers, that it can also be challenging for sure.
Yeah. And we're going to unpack some of those challenges in just a little bit, but I want you to please continue to paint the picture of the company. Help our listeners understand, where do you operate? What are the exact services that you're providing, the conditions that you're treating? How do you look to set Family Spring apart from the other behavioral health providers in your market?
Yeah, so we're out here in California. We're based in the Bay Area. We have a brick and mortar shop in Berkeley, and we are expanding our in-person services around the Bay Area first. We do telehealth and in-person services, and of course, all of our clinicians are licensed here in California, so we do serve patients across the state of California, and we do have a plan to expand satellite offices throughout California. We have two major wings. One is our outpatient clinic, and that's the biggest portion of our business, where we, you know, 95% of our business is contracted through insurance and health plans. And so most of our contracts are for mild to moderate symptomology. So we get referred, you know, people with mild to moderate anxiety, depression, trauma, and substance use. And those are probably the biggest, in that order too, the biggest challenges that we see. Right now, we're still doing probably about 75 to 80% telehealth, just because the requests are coming in. You know, we have people who live somewhat rurally outside of the Bay Area, but they're insured with our health plan, and they're not going to drive 45 minutes to the office or something like that. So that's the biggest portion of our business. Most of those clientele are young adults and adults, just because most people who are insured are adults and over the age of 18. And then we also have some very niche specific services that we provide too with the local probation departments. So we do mindfulness-based substance abuse treatment, which is an intervention that I co-developed kind of in my previous clinical career when I was really knee-deep clinically doing research, developing interventions, things like that. And we got this intervention essentially to be a promising evidence-based intervention. The original research was actually done with probation youth. So through some of my contacts and relationships, we were approached by local probation departments to essentially provide intensive, specified substance use disorder counseling services. And so we do that in three of the local counties here in the Bay Area. And those services are very, very different than our kind of mild to moderate telehealth services. They take specific recruitment. They take a specific type of clinician who is passionate, not just passionate about the work itself, but also is willing to deal with some of the challenges inherent just in working in bureaucratic institutions. We go on site into these juvenile halls and do group in one-on-one therapy. We do some telehealth with them when necessary, but most of it is on site or out in the field. And although that's a smaller portion of our business, we seem to keep growing that wing just because there is a huge gap in those services. And, you know, every chief probation officer or kind of institutional services manager I talk to in another county is just like, we can't find providers to fill these gaps. It's really, really difficult. So those two kind of wings of the business really came from different professional experiences that I've had personally and the relationships that I've been able to build and the contracts that we've been able to get. And both of them are growing, both the probation and the specified side with substance use disorder, and also kind of our more generalist outpatient wing with more clinicians and more health plans that we're bringing on.
Awesome. That was a fantastic overview of the business. So just for our listeners who are tuning in, Sam and I, we first chatted a week or so ago. Sam responded to one of the call for speaker emails that I put out there because he was interested in Invest as somebody who is building a business and looking to grow. Sam, I was hoping on the podcast now you can maybe explain what your goals are for the business over the next 2 years or so. I know growth is kind of a number one priority for you. How do you plan to grow? What's that roadmap look like?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it is definitely growth. And growth is simple for us, not necessarily easy, but simple. It just means making sure our operational staff are able to do what they need to do to run our ship, you know, smoothly or relatively smoothly, so that we can continue to recruit and hire clinicians, because more clinicians equals more growth. We both will generate more revenue that way. And of course, the most important thing, we will serve more patients across the state of California, you know, at least for now. We may expand interstate at some point in the future, but given that California is the fifth largest economy in the world, you know, it's okay for now. The way we think about growth is, for me personally as a CEO, one of my many jobs is to make sure I have the right people around me who can help out with all aspects of the business. You know, my co-founder is our COO, and he essentially manages the internal operations of the business, so I don't necessarily have to. And so I have a small team of people around me working on recruitment. I work on recruitment a lot. One of our core values at FamilySpring is connection. Of course, connection with our clients, connection with our employees, and of course, connection with the community. And so one of the ways I spend my time, one of the things I love doing, podcasts like this, meeting folks like yourself, but also connecting with clinicians in the local community as well. I probably have, you know, anywhere from 3 to 10 calls booked per week with clinicians that I may be recruiting. We may be talking to each other just to refer to one another, or I may be pitching them on something else about FamilySpring services or offerings or something like that. So a lot of it comes down to getting our company out there, meeting with people, you know, mostly on Zoom, but sometimes in person, and letting them know, like, hey, this is who we are as a company, and this is where we fit in terms of your professional path. And if that's, you know, in alignment with them, then we move to another step, which is, you know, oftentimes a formalized interview, a structured formal interview, where we will then, you know, determine if they actually do fit the needs of our company and if we fit their needs as well. So it's a lot of talking to clinicians. It's a lot. And for me, I find that I don't know what the experience is of other recruiters out there. The recruitment firm we use, all of their recruiters are also licensed clinicians. And I talk with them often about how we're able to kind of get to the top of the inbox in other therapists' LinkedIn or email, just because we have the letters behind our names. They know we're licensed. And it oftentimes will start the conversation, you know, a little bit more easily. So I'm recruiting a lot, and I like doing that. I really do, because it helps me get exposed to more people, to more services in the community, and it ultimately fulfills our mission of growth and helping more people.
You clearly have some big goals over the next few years as you look to grow the business. What do you see as some of the biggest challenges that stand in the way of those goals? I mean, obviously the recruitment aspect is really tough, particularly right now.
Yes. Yeah, that is the other side of the coin. On the one hand, I really like recruiting. I like meeting new people. On the other hand, it is tough to recruit. I mean, there is a provider shortage. Despite whatever LinkedIn posts people see or don't see, I'm finding that it's very hard to find the right people, particularly with specialized training. And so, you know, it's a grind to do that. That's on the one hand, but it is possible, as long as, you know, you're in some sense, it's like I'm pounding the pavement on LinkedIn or on other platforms to get in front of people. And that's just a grind. On the other hand, it's the other side of the coin is the health plans that we partner with. Part of, you know, my job also is not just recruiting people, but it's also getting us into new networks that actually make sense for us. I've passed on networks that that won't pay as much. And I'm thinking about my employees. I'm thinking about people who are, you know, we're paying their healthcare, they have mortgages, they have rent to pay, they have families, all of these things. And so if, a regional contract manager at a major health plan kind of undercuts what I think our value is, of course, I'll try to negotiate, I'll try to get those numbers up, but ultimately I'll pass on it because I think our employees are worth it, you know? And we do a percentage split model with our employees. They're all W-2 employees. But when we get a raise or when we get more money as a business, they get more money as a business. And so we're aligned in that way. And that's a challenge. It's a challenge to get into new networks when you have certain contracts that you have that are established, and then you meet new contract managers or health plans, and they kind of want you to start from ground zero, you know? So those two things I would say are the biggest barriers. But the recruitment side is tough because I just don't think we're pumping out enough licensed clinicians, which is what we utilize here at Family Spring, to fill the need to meet the mental health crisis. In another conversation, maybe on another podcast, I'd love to go down the rabbit hole of what I think is really necessary there, which is more, you know, peer support, more paraprofessionals, more training for people who want to do this work, but they're never going to get a master's degree or a PhD or something like that. That's one way we can fill the gap. But in terms of licensed folks, it's tough. It's really, really tough. That's what comes to mind for me to answer that question right now.
I always love talking to entrepreneurs in particular in our space because I learn a new management or leadership tip each and every time that I could take back to my own team. What would you say are some of the top lessons that you've learned as a leader as you've looked to grow your business?
Yeah, I think for me, the top one or two that jump out are that, you know, despite the fact that connection is a very, very, very strong value for me, and it is personally, it's in, you know, with my company, everything, having authentic relationships at the company level is very doable, but they are professional. Sometimes I've like wanted, you know, I'm a person that I would at least describe myself as somebody who has good boundaries, who can be firm, I can be a leader, all of those things. And sometimes, you know, a lot of my employees, everybody kind of wants something a little bit different when it comes to their wants and needs and things like that. And so sometimes when like somebody asks for a different benefit or something like that, I really want to give it to them. There's that urge inside of me to just to do that. But what I've learned over the years is that in order to scale, whether you're scaling fast in venture or doing more manageable growth in a company like ours, standard operating procedures and policies are kind of reign supreme, and being very thoughtful about those so that the company can grow, so that all of us, everybody is replaceable. To me, that's the biggest thing I've learned. So on the one hand, it's like, I'm very relational. I'm a human being. I'm very humanistically oriented just as a person and also as a therapist too. But on the other hand, learning about the structure of the business and being able to have standard operating procedures and policies so that, you know, not that they can never be changed. Of course, they can be edited. But pointing those towards those as our North Stars for how to operate the company has been a learning experience for me and extremely helpful. That to me, what your question really pinged inside of me is like, if I were to talk to other aspiring clinicians who are aspiring entrepreneurs, it's easy for us to be empathetic, clinicians at least, right? We go into this business for a reason. It's more difficult for a lot of clinicians, at least in my experience, to learn the business side, which is very attainable. A lot of us have the personality for it. I would consider myself in that camp, but there's still a learning curve, and it still needs to happen, because if not, then the whole ship could sink and become unearthed, and then you face a lot more problems. So to me, I find a lot of respite, as corny and as nerdy as it sounds, I find a lot of respite in standard operating procedures, SOPs, as me and my business partner call them.
Sam, you've provided a lot of insight on yourself, on the business. Now, I kind of want to take a step back and talk about the behavioral health industry overall. What are the trends that you're most interested in and why? What are you watching most closely and why?
Yes, great question. You know, as somebody who runs a clinic or who runs a company who contracts, you know, 95 to 97% insurance, I'm most interested in value-based care. And I'll tell you that for me, one of the things that I did before I became an entrepreneur, I was still a clinician. I originally thought I wanted to be in academia. I wanted to do clinical work and do research and teach. And so I've taught research, evidence-based research at the highest level, quantitative research, qualitative research, mixed methods research. I've learned over the course of my career about how, you know, a quote unquote valid instrument like the PHQ-9 or the GAD-7, how that gets created. And so zooming back out to value-based care, I'm most interested in it because most of the conversations I hear happening at value-based care, it's not to put it down in any way, because I'm actually all for it. And this is a clinician who operates a clinic. I'm all for value-based care. I think there's kind of a misnomer fallacy out there about how clinicians don't necessarily want that. What the thing that comes up for me when I hear it, though, is what exactly are we talking about here? And I don't think people or the industry or whatever you want to call it, it doesn't seem clearly defined to me. Because we can go off into kind of a rabbit hole or a tangent about, what is the value we're providing? Are you looking for attendance metrics? Are you looking for, patient satisfaction and engagement? Are you actually looking for movement in terms of treatment progress, like doing pre and post measures and showing that depression symptoms or anxiety symptoms, for example, are decreasing over time? Those are all three very, very different things. And the other reason why I'm so interested in it is because in my experience, I'm interacting with different insurance plans, asking for raises, getting us in network, you know, making sure the partnership is a true partnership, et cetera, et cetera. In each of these insurance plans, these health plans, they just operate so differently. I've heard nothing from them, you know, at least at our level, which is the level of kind of grassroots provider who've come in from the bottom up, you know, rather than like a relationship with somebody in private equity or VC who knows somebody who knows somebody who can get us into the room with like the higher ups at you know, one of these major insurances. We're coming in from the ground up, essentially just submitting applications to regional contract network managers and paneling with them because we're all, you know, licensed. I'm not hearing anything about it. So at the conference level, and then, you know, when I go on LinkedIn, I enjoy reading about it. I think it's a good direction for the industry to go in. But I'm like, you know, what are we talking about specifically? Because most events that I go to or speakers I hear or articles I read don't get into at least the nuance on what it can actually be. I'm hopeful, though. I hope to, you know, contribute to that over time and work with our payers and our partners to give them my knowledge as well, just coming from a research background about how to look for evidence and what should really be taken into account when you're, for example, you know, contracting with a clinic or with a provider who has real targets on the hook, not just what they want to do, you know, let's say with measurement-based care, but they have employees who they need to treat well, hopefully, and pay and make sure that, you know, the employment is conducive to not just a lot of turnover, right? Which is one of my, you know, core values as well, as really being employee-centric.
Sam, what you just said, that last answer, really resonated with me, because here at Behavioral Health Business, we just recently hosted our big spring event, Value.
Yes.
It took place this past March in Miami. And that's all about payment innovation and value-based care. And so many people there, I think, shared a lot of those same concerns about really defining what we mean by measurement-based care versus measurement-informed care. And I think we got into this pattern where at the beginning of every panel, right off the bat, we had to say, this is what we mean when we say measurement-based care. this is what we mean when we say measurement-informed care. And I get the sense that at least those conversations are starting to happen more so than in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they are. And I think, you know, I wasn't able to attend Value this last year, but I believe I went the year before that when it was in, I think it was in DC. I can't remember exactly where it was, but yeah, I think it's great that you put that conference on. I think that's what we need more of. We need to get into the same room and we need to continuously refine, because the more we're able to do that, the more we can define what we actually mean. And then we can start to really execute at a higher level. And most of the clinicians that I talk to about what it could be, at least in my mind, they're all for it. They're ready for those types of things because they just want to help their patients, you know? So I think there's a lot of potential in that kind of arc of the industry.
Sam, you have a great memory. Value 2 years ago was in fact in DC. I unfortunately couldn't make it for good reasons, though. I was a new dad for the first time.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. That's been a wild ride, and that's for a different podcast as well, probably.
Yes.
But I really enjoyed chatting with you. I think we are just out of time. Hopefully, at one of the upcoming conferences, we'll get a chance to meet each other in person.
Absolutely. I look forward to it. Thanks for having me.
That does it for this episode of the Behavioral Health Business Perspectives Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Holly with BHB, a WTWH media company, signing off.